Accession number 15228, reel 3.
Geoffrey Amor, side 3.
I suppose the end of the war in Germany was in the first few weeks and months afterwards, was a bit of a phony time. I remember the first 2 days after, there was no flying. The Germans were streaming in from the east by road to get away from the Russians. Aircraft were being flown into the airfield of all sorts and landing, and the crews, of course, being taken prisoner. But after 2 days, there was an area in Schleswig-Holstein, I remember, where one or two airfields up there, the RAF regiment hadn't yet got to, but the Germans were still holding them. And we spent two or three days, and perhaps the best sort of flying you can get, beating hell out of these airfields with nothing shooting at you. And this was to keep the Germans, let the Germans know that they'd had it. We were in command before the troops got up and actually took over these places. From then on, I suppose, it was getting used to these aircraft, our own aircraft. We had an Australian flight commander come in, Tony Gaze, who had the distinction of starting the war with 616 Squadron and indeed finishing the war with 616. He had either two or three DFCs, and he had had a great career. But he was a natural. He could fly anything. And he found a line of Focke-Wulf 190s, production line, not far away. And he got himself down there and flew one back, a brand new aircraft. And he used to fly this around the place and terrorize everyone in an extraordinary manner. We also got hold of two ME-262s, which the squadron commander and one of the other pilots flew back to Lübeck. The one pilot got his down safely. The squadron commander, I think if I remember rightly, dug his nose wheel in on landing. Anyway, we had them there. We thought we were going to be able to fly them. We weren't. Occasionally we'd go and try and start them. But this was all frowned upon shortly afterwards. I think too many people were trying to do this sort of thing with too many aircraft, and there were too many accidents. But it was all part of the fun. This Tony Gaze also got hold of a little twin-engine transport airplane, German transport airplane, I think the Siebel 202. And he could fly that. So he used to go to Copenhagen and bring back 2,000 eggs in exchange for chocolate and coffee and cigarettes and this sort of stuff. Locally, the Germans were very head down. There was certainly no fraternization. And similarly with the Russians, who were on the edge of the airfield and on the edge of the eastern edge of the Ratzberger Lake, which is just below the airfield. And we got hold of two or three boats of one description or another down on the lake, and we used to go water skiing. And the Russians would be sitting on the eastern bank without a flicker of emotion. They're sitting there with a Tommy gun sort of pointing at you, but there's nothing going on at all. And with the local German population, much the same. We did manage to get most of our laundry done, as I remember it, by the local Germans. I think our batman organized it in some way. I think we used to give them a packet of 10 cigarettes and a tablet of soap with each bundle. And that was the payment. But it was done extremely well, but we had no touch with that in any sense. Any way in which we got to know one or two was we got hold of a boat up on Travemunde Bay. I think it was a torpedo recovery boat, and that became the squadron boat. So we used to go up there weekends and odd afternoons, and there was a German crew of two used to drive this. And I think on one occasion, towards the end, we let them bring their girlfriends out on the boat as well. And we managed to get some hooch from somewhere or the other. But more than that, I think you could say there was no fraternization. It wasn't on. So it was a pretty phony period. There were then, starting for exhibitions. We went up to Copenhagen on two occasions, I remember, as a squadron, for some celebrations there, in which we had to do squadron flypasts and formation flypasts, which meant two or three days at a time we went up there. There was another flypast from Marshal Zhukov, the Russians, somewhere in the area. But that was we were back to perhaps fairly peacetime type flying.
Very suddenly.
Pretty suddenly. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed it was. Yep. Yep. And I'd say we all took a fair bit of leave, you know, at the same time, during that rundown.
Was there a feeling of exhaustion among you? Or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. We were all young. We're all young and hopefully pretty fit. No, I don't think so. No.
And up to VE Day, had you been flying very intensively?
No, not all intensively. No, we didn't have too many aircraft. We had engine problems, so you'd have aircraft grounded waiting for a new engine to come out. On one occasion, we ran out of fuel. We were the only aircraft using, paraffin, as it was called, and that had to be flown in, I think, in drums. So these sort of things controlled how much flying you could actually do. So no, it wasn't all that intensive at all. And certainly no night flying, so purely sort of daylight hours. No, it wasn't intensive.
So you stayed on in the peacetime Air Force and got commissioned?
I did, yep. Came back to the country, joined another meteor squadron, or stayed with 263 squadron, until the end of 46 when I was then converted to Tempest, which we took out to the Middle East to reinforce the squadrons there, and I went on, in fact, to 8th Squadron in Aden for 2 years, where our role there primarily was to look after the Raucus and tribesmen up in the Aden Protectorate. So that was quite a busy time.
That was a sort of strike role, wasn't it?
It was a very much ground attack role, yep. And every 3 months or so it would flare up and we'd have a busy period for a week until they quietened down again. From there I came home, joined 257 Squadron at Horsington Face at Norwich. We then moved down with Meteor 8 to Wattisham near Ipswich, where I was a flight commander. And from there I went to the RAF Flying College for 3 years as a flight commander on their fighter squadron with Meteors and Vampires, and as one of the two pilot attack instructors to the college. And I then also did a bit of flying with Canberras, which came in. Then I was sent off, much to one's dismay, as always, for my first ground tour to headquarters transport command at Upavon in Wiltshire. Fortunately, promoted squadron leader, and then perhaps the best tour of the lot, I was posted to New Zealand on an exchange tour to the New Zealand Air Force to command their one and only home-based jet fighter squadron, which was number 75. A very hectic, very busy 2 years, in which I had, I suppose, the good fortune and a great deal of honour, because it was the first New Zealand squadron to receive a standard. And that was presented by the Queen Mother during a visit at the beginning of 58. And whereas in this country, the ceremony normally held on the home airfield, there it was held in the local town of Palmerston North because more people would be able to see it. And it was, in fact, broadcast direct over all five national radio programs before the days of television. So they made quite a big thing of it, and fortunately it went off well. That was followed 2 months later by the celebrations for the RNZAF's 21st birthday, where again it was held at the base at Ahakia, where the squadron was, and we opened it by flying a figure 21 and then coming back as a figure 75 for the squadron. So two quite big occasions. In fact, the 21st birthday, I forget now the crowd that was estimated. I think they thought they might get 50,000. In the end, they were swamped. And the thought is that something like 250,000, the biggest crowd ever seen in New Zealand. And the roads and everywhere was absolutely swamped. They just couldn't move. And the dignitaries that came up from Wellington, So with the weather, which had come down badly, the Prime Minister and people all had to be flown back. Who had flown in couldn't, but they had to wait until cars could be found for them to take them back by road once they could get out from the crowds. It was quite an occasion. Come on. Yeah. That was a great 2 years. We made a large number of friends who still come over and visit us, and we've been back once to see them. But all things don't go according to plan. I told you that earlier that this airfield at Palmerston North was grass and there was having a hard runway put down. When that was officially opened, it was done by the Prime Minister of the day. And Pat and I were invited to the civic luncheon preceding the ceremony with the Prime Minister, etc. But the squadron had to fly a fly past after the opening ceremonies, which the senior flight commander had to do. And I had arranged that after lunch, when we went to the airfield, I would break away from the official party and I would go to the control tower to alert them when to get airborne. Now, I found out that the mayor was going to speak first, then the local MP, then the Prime Minister. So I got from the Lord Mayor that he would speak for about 10 minutes. The local MP was a bit cagey about how long, but he said, well, no longer than 15. So then the Prime Minister's office, and he wouldn't come up. And I tried to explain that the aircraft, low level, only 20 miles away, I know, but 12 flogging about low level, they use a lot of juice very quickly. And he said, and the only thing he'd come up with, he said, when I've got about 2 minutes to go, I will say, I won't keep you much longer, about another couple of minutes. So I said, myself, when do I get him airborne? So I said, right, well, the 10 minutes when he finishes, when the MP finishes, then the Prime Minister. So I give him 10 minutes, then say, get airborne. And he went on for 45 minutes. And the flight commander caught up and said, we're getting a bit short. Is he finishing yet? And so this went on. Boy, I was sweating. And then eventually he came up and said, well, I've got about 2 minutes. I said, 2 minutes? They get lined up. And they made it. But it was getting very tight. So that was one of those occasions you don't want every day.
Right. Going back, I'm interested because you flew a number of different marks of meteors, and you must have been aware of the progress that was made, you know, as they went up the Lenny curve. I mean, I presume you flew the 4 and the 8.
Yeah.
The 8, of course, was, I imagine, a dramatic contrast to the 3, was it?
Well, the 4 was, to me, was a big contrast. The 4 had the power basically the same as the 8. That was the one that really had the extra power. That's where you really notice it. The 8 became a very nice refinement of that, with a different tail, gave you a better and a longer fuselage, rather more fuel, much more stable. The early marks tended to get the snaking effect. The longer fuselage, the different tail, pretty well ruled that out.
And you had an ejection seat.
You had an ejection seat if things went wrong. But you see, when you start, people having been brought up with sitting on a parachute, that, you know, if things get really bad, you'll get out. And so you had a pin, a safety pin with a big disc on, which you're supposed to take out. Having got in, strapped in, as you taxi out, take your pin out, stay away. People would taxi out to begin with. The air traffic would call up and said, you still got your pin in? He said, yeah, I know, I'll get it out if I need to. And the tendency was to leave it in, initially, in the ejection seat. People were saying, I don't want that thing underneath me going off inadvertently. So it was a strange attitude to begin with, wasn't it?